Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books Network Seminar. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. I just got off the Skype phone with Tom Van Doren to talk about his new book, Flightways: Life and Loss at the Edge of Extinction. This came out just in 2014 with Columbia University Press. And you'll hear me get very excited about this book in the interview to come. I really, really loved it. It's a book that simultaneously is both informed by and also speaks to quite a few disciplines across the arts and the sciences in a way that's really thoughtful, really informed, and really, really rigorous, while at the same time being extraordinarily generous and empathetic. So what it does is it brings us into a kind of thoughtful account and a study of and an opening up of ideas of extinction by looking at five distinct groups of birds that are all either extinct or on the way to extinction in different ways. So we look here at albatrosses, vultures, penguins, cranes, and crows. In the course of this book, Van Doren weaves in a lot of work on animal studies and also environmental studies or environmental humanities. So the book really becomes a kind of conversation among the case studies, his own ethnographic work, his archival work, and also the contributions that he's bringing in from across these fields and really encountering and celebrating in a way that performs, as you'll hear me say at the end of the interview, a really profound generosity and collegial generosity that I think models the kind of attentiveness to relationships and entanglements that the book is all about. So this is a book for you if you're interested in the human and non-human, although the book kind of undoes that polarity between human and non-human in, I think, a really productive way. It's a book about extinction. It's for you if you know a lot about animal studies, and it's for you if you know nothing about animal studies. It's also a book that's deeply committed to the craft and the power of storytelling. So this is really a book about stories and storytelling as much as it's a book about extinction and flightways and birds. It was really a pleasure to talk with Tom about this, and I deeply, deeply enjoyed the book and have been using it and working with it since reading it. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy, and I hope you have a chance to read it. I'm here today to talk with Tom Van Doren about his new book, Flightways. Welcome to the New Books Network Seminar, Tom, and thanks for making time to talk with me today and also for writing an exceptionally amazing book. I loved it, and I'm really excited to talk with you about it today. So welcome.
Hi, Carla. Thanks very much. It's great to talk to you too.
So let's get started by talking a little bit about how you came to the field, and specifically, what brought you to work in environmental humanities?
Well, I guess I started out as an undergraduate in environmental philosophy, or in philosophy with an interest in the environment, and there wasn't a lot of environment going in philosophy departments, well, not in mine anyway. So I tried to pick up biology and other things like that. And I guess I always remained much more interested in the humanities, but wanted to think about environmental issues. So philosophy, I suppose, was my grounding. But I was really lucky in that when I went on to do my PhD at the Australian National University, we had a group there, the Ecological Humanities Group, that was really comprised at that stage of Debbie Bird Rose, who's a great environmental anthropologist, Val Plumwood, who was a fantastic ecofeminist philosopher, and Libby Robin, who's an environmental historian, and their students. So it was an intimate group, but we were exposed to historical, philosophical, and anthropological scholarship on the environment, and we were really encouraged to think about the connections between our work, to think about the kinds of conversations we might have, the resources we might draw on from those other fields. And that really rubbed off on me, I guess, and that I think has continued to color the way that I write, the way that I research, the way that I think about all of these kinds of issues. So I guess it was kind of a lucky situation. I should also say that I was influenced very early on by Donna Haraway's work, in particular, mm-hmm. feminist STS scholarship, And that I think is also there, and I suppose in all of my work and the way that she works through questions of ethics and politics in relation to environmental issues, but also drawing on concrete case studies, so the situatedness of her work that is still able to grapple with really big issues. So I guess that's how I arrived at the particular take that I have on birds and extinction in this book, and it's coloured, you know, all of my subsequent projects.
Great, and you can actually see, or I can see as a reader, both the influence of Donna Haraway in really wonderful ways in the book, and also the deep interdisciplinarity that you've described as part of your training that really shapes every part of every chapter. And it's a really wonderful modeling of what can happen by bringing a deeply interdisciplinary approach to a study like this. So I think it works really, really well. So the book that we're talking about today offers us and also implicates us in stories about five groups of birds, and we'll talk about them in turn over the course of our hour together. We have albatrosses, we have vultures in India specifically, little penguins, whooping cranes in North America, and Hawaiian crows. And it tells these stories and, again, involves us in these stories as a way to explore and reimagine what, where, and how extinction is and why that matters. So how did you come to this project, Tom, and how did you come to the decision to write a book-length object devoted to this topic?
Well, I wrote my PhD on intellectual property in plant genetic resources was one of the main topics. I was interested more broadly, I guess, in agricultural plant genetic resources and the regimes of control and ownership that surround them. But throughout that work, I think what interested me most was the conservation aspects of it, the conservation of plant genetic resources. So that got me into thinking about conservation, I suppose, and I moved from agricultural domains to broader biodiversity questions. But I had started out wanting to write a book on extinction more broadly that was going to look at case studies from across all of the kingdoms of life and take up these kinds of big questions. And I guess I just got captivated by birds early on. So I started out with the Indian vultures that are the second chapter in the book. And from there, I guess there are a lot of reasons I was captivated by birds. Part of it was that I went and relearned a lot of avian biology that I had sort of dabbled in as an undergraduate a little bit and never taken up seriously. And I began to look more seriously at the ethological literature and a lot of the ecological literature on birds as pollinators and the other ecological roles they have. And I guess I just got really interested in birds. So it was the book became a lot more tightly focused, I guess, and I found other avian case studies. But I'm not a birder now, and I never have been. So I guess it's in each case it was the individual story that captured me. But the larger project of thinking about extinction and thinking ethnographically and ethically about extinction was something that I really started with Deborah Bird Rose. I don't know how long ago now, about 8 years ago, we started talking about what we were then thinking of as biographies of extinction and what it would mean to tell the life story, if you like, of a mass death, and to web together those kinds of individual stories to say something more general about this current period that is quite possibly the sixth mass extinction event in Earth's history.
So even though there are five major case studies of birds, the book actually opens with a sixth. The introduction opens with the dodo, what you call the poster child for extinction in a lot of ways. Now, dodos were big flightless birds that lived on Mauritius, and evidence, as you tell us in the introduction, suggests that they may have been extinct already by the end of the 17th century. Now, also, as you tell us here, they've become so iconic in discussions of extinction, in part because of the ways they've been narrativized in written accounts. And this really brings us to one of what I take to be the major contributions of and arguments of the book, and this is the connection between extinction and storytelling. So to bring us in here and maybe start right at the ground and right at the beginning, Can you talk a little bit about this commitment to the connection between extinction and storytelling? What do we need to know about that commitment and about that connection right at the beginning now to be able to understand what's going to come next?
Okay. Sorry. Well,
it's a big question.
Yeah. I'm thinking in the book about lively storytelling. That's the way I try to frame it. So to think about stories as committed to life, to the living world. So there's that ethical and political edge from the beginning. But also to think about stories themselves as lively, as contributors to the becoming of the world. So I wanted to resist that clean distinction between the narrated and the actual world. To think about how stories are technologies for worlding, I think Haraway says at one point somewhere. So how they are implicated in the becoming of the world. And in that sense, lively also. So I guess combining those two things, the point of storytelling is a much more political one. It's not about a kind of simple, clean, communicative act. It's about implicating others. So how we can tell stories that draw others in, that make others perhaps curious, responsible in new kinds of ways, how learning something new about the world, being restoried into the world in a new way through the experience of reading or hearing a story, draws us into a different kind of world and makes us accountable in new kinds of ways. So that's the larger project of the book. And then each of those stories is an effort to, each of the chapters is an effort to tell a different kind of story that draws people in different ways.
Now, the book doesn't just expand our notion of where and what and how storytelling is and how we are not just implicated in hearing and experiencing the stories, but also being part of those stories. The connection between storytelling and extinction also asks us to re-envision what extinction is and how it is. So can you talk a little bit about that? The book really expands our notion of what extinction is beyond simply the death of the last single individual in a group. So would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was really interested in the entangled significance of extinction. So part of what the stories enable me to do is to draw on the biology and ecology and ethology to try and give a fleshier sense of the particular species that I'm writing about how they hunt or reproduce, about what that particular way of life of that species is, to give a fuller sense of what is being lost and also of why it matters. But this notion of entangled significance then is about following the threads to think about how species matter to ecosystems. They might matter to a particular tree variety that they're a pollinator or a seed disperser for. Birds might matter for various cultural or religious reasons to different human communities. So this notion of entangled significance is about all of the ways that that these species are tangled up and significant to others. And so, again, this is about thickening up our notion of what this species is and why it matters, and so coming to understand that loss in a new way. So that's, another part of what I'm trying to do with the stories and how it is that they might implicate us in extinction in new ways.
And this actually really beautifully leads us in to the first chapter of the book. In the first chapter, you're here really proposing a way of thinking about species as achievements, as you put it. And you're proposing that we understand a being not just as a sort of a kind, but as a way of life, as a form of life, as a flight way, as you call it. And that's also the inspiration for the title of the book. Now, you do this through the case study of black-footed albatrosses and Laysan albatrosses that live on Midway Atoll in the North Pacific Ocean. So to bring us into this chapter and to perhaps illustrate this notion of a flight way and a species as achievement through this particular case, can you talk about the flight way of the albatross, as you depict it here in the early part of this chapter.
Yeah, the notion of the flightway, I guess, was again trying to get it at two things. The first one was to think about what species are, and I guess in a book about extinction, it seemed important to me to have a bit of a think about what a species is, what it is that is ending with extinction. And so I was interested in, as with all of the chapters in this book, there's an awful lot of historical and philosophical research that informs my thinking that I don't find any way to get into the chapter because I feel that it disrupts the narrative too much. So some of it makes it into footnotes, but most of it disappears, sadly. So I got really interested in thinking about the history of the species concept or species concepts and how they've changed since Darwin to obviously a particularly central figure. So how to think about a species not as a kind and certainly not as an eternal kind, but rather as something that's evolving, as something that's stretched over millions of years from an act of speciation to extinction, and something that is evolving and changing over that period. So the first thing I wanted to do with the notion of flightway was to try and convey that sense of magnitude of a line of movement over millions of years of evolutionary history, and that in a sense is what a species is. It's a lineage that moves, if you like, over these vast periods of time. But then, as you just said, I wanted to thicken that up and to think about that not just as a kind of empty trajectory, but as a way of life that is moving over millions of years, that is evolving and adapting, and that is tangled up with other ways of life in consequential, sometimes co-evolutionary ways. So the flightway was an effort to think about what a species is, again, in a slightly different way, that might, again, as with all of the chapters in the book, that might help us to rethink extinction in a slightly different way. And the albatross was really a way into that because of the work that goes into each generation into rearing, to laying eggs and rearing chicks and fledging chicks, months and months of work each year that enables one generation to bring the next into the world. And that, again, helps us to think about species as something that don't just happen but that are achieved, and all of that labour that goes into the production, the maintenance of a species in the world as something that we might value and come to appreciate, but something that I think is ultimately impossible to really grasp, the millions and millions of generations and that of labour that holds something like the albatross in the world that can be undone so quickly with, in this case, the 50, 60 years of industrial fishing and plastics and organochlorines and other kinds of toxins in the water that are, you know, have these really very short histories, 50, 60, 70 years, but that are undoing these kinds of millions of years, year histories so quickly.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the things that you're just mentioning illustrates how, again, deeply interdisciplinary the book is. And I think that's true not just in terms of what goes into it, but what could potentially come out of it. I mean, just in terms of describing species as achievements and invoking the notion of labor, this immediately becomes, at that moment, part of a way of rethinking labor history, right? To make it not so distinctly a human kind of a historiographical field, which I think itself is really interesting. But you just mentioned the plastics, right, and the pollutants. Now, the chapter talks a lot about the presence of plastic objects around and inside the albatrosses, and also talks about the presence of other pollutants like PCBs and DDT. You mentioned that these substances are kinds of hyper-objects, according to the notion of Timothy Morton, and this is, I mentioned that because this is a book that Timothy and I talked about actually a little bit ago that I think speaks very nicely to this case. Now, you make a compelling point here for thinking about the very different temporalities that meet at the site of albatross encounter in terms of the daily life of the birds, the future of the species, and the time scales of plastics and other pollutants, which are in some ways immortal. So can you talk a little bit about this issue of temporalities? What's crucial for us to understand about the temporality issue here in order for us to understand the work that you're doing in this chapter?
Yeah, I struggle with temporalities. I find them difficult to think. And so in many ways, this chapter was my first foray into trying to think temporalities in a way that I sort of felt I needed to think about extinction. And that first chapter was actually one of the last ones, maybe even the last one that I wrote. A lot of the ways that I was thinking about extinction were coming from the work of Michelle Bastian, who's at the University of Edinburgh. And she, I think, is, for those who are interested in thinking about temporality, I would direct them to her work, not mine. So she, I think, is really thinking about time in really interesting ways, time and community, time and a range of environmental issues, including now extinction. But what I'm trying to do there, as I guess I gestured to a moment ago, is to think about this, the radical difference between the millions of year history of speciation of something like the albatross and the very short period of time in which we can undo that history. And partly I was drawn to think about that by a comment that was made far too often, I think, by journalists, by colleagues, who point to the fact that extinction is something that now that we now know since Darwin is an unavoidable part of the life of a species. All species will go extinct. We know that 99.9% of those that have ever lived have gone extinct. And so in the grand scheme of things, why does extinction matter? And I'm not happy with the kind of answer that we get from a lot of environmental philosophers, which is to say that I think Holmes Rolston III put it most succinctly when he said that that a kind of a natural extinction would be like death from natural causes, but a human-induced extinction is like murder. And so we ought to object to extinction on those grounds. And I think for obvious reasons, for those people who are working in kind of STS frames or working with ecofeminist philosophy and critical of dualisms, I think that this kind of hard and fast distinction between humans as agents and the natural world is problematic. So I was trying to think about what it is that I'm objecting to in extinction in other terms. Mm-hmm.
The non-human is entering into our conversation. That's the New Books Network seminar cat who's trying to get a word in edgewise.
Yeah.
So apologies for that. But go on. You were talking about what you were trying to do with extinction.
So I guess the temporality thing was a way of thinking for me about what's wrong with that kind of question about why we don't just accept extinction as a natural phenomenon. And for me, it's about temporal scale, and it's about taking that view from nowhere and saying extinction happens all the time, therefore there's nothing wrong with it. In the grand scheme, from the perspective of life or evolution or whoever the agent is imagined to be, extinction is not consequential, and I don't think that's really very helpful. So the more situated take that I'm trying to offer in the book about entanglements, about the way in which different species matter, about what unravels, how worlds unravel in the context of extinction, can all just be presented as change, that the world is changing, but it's highly consequential change. And so being mindful of how a particular extinction matters, I think, is important, but also being mindful of our own situatedness, that we ought not to adopt the position from nowhere, the view from nowhere, and just say extinction is a natural phenomenon. Instead, what does extinction mean for this community of humans and non-humans now who will actually live through it? How does it impoverish worlds for those to come? From the perspective of our own species, co-evolved with a lot of these organisms in different ways. So they might be our companion species, thinking with Haraway. These extinctions are really consequential. And so I think we have to refuse that view from nowhere and adopt the more short term, time frames of our own species or even of our own cultures or of us as individuals, and think about what extinction means from those temporal scales.
Now, this issue of entanglement is explored even further when we move into the second chapter of the book, and this is a chapter that looks carefully at the entanglements of vultures with people, cows, and others in India. Now, entanglements here are not just of the human and non-human, but also of the living and the dead in really interesting ways. So in India, vulture species are rapidly approaching extinction. For listeners who don't know very much about this particular case in this particular context, could you maybe say a little bit about that before we then move on to talk about some of the other issues happening in this chapter?
Yeah, I'll try and be brief. It seems that the vultures were being poisoned by an anti-inflammatory drug called diclofenac. It was given to cattle. It's good for cattle, but when the cattle die and are consumed by vultures, it causes all sorts of problems for the vultures and eventually death. So this was went on for several decades while biologists, well, until it was even noticed that the vultures were declining. And then for another decade or so afterwards, with an effort to determine what was the cause. Once this was found, eventually a ban was put in on the drug. But by that stage, already estimates vary, but probably somewhere around 97-99% of the vultures, the gyps, vultures of the genus gyps in India had already died. So there is an ongoing conservation project there, and perhaps those species are beginning to do a bit better. But it was an incredible impact on what was once the most abundant bird of prey in the world. Those populations just plummeted, and with all of these knock-on ecological effects.
Now, you talk about the importance of this poisoning in part coming from the fact that vultures are eating cows, because vultures are such an important part of the ecology of dealing with death in this context. So in some communities in India, as this chapter of the book describes, vultures are actually relied upon to consume the dead, and that's both non-human, so cows, but also human dead. Can you talk a little bit about this aspect of vultures as part of this in series of entanglements of life and death in this context?
Yeah, well, as you said a moment ago, I was trying to think about communities of the human and the non-human, the living and the dead, and to think about how they are held together through, I don't think about it in terms of labor in that chapter, but through the work of or the activities, the lives of different beings. And so then again, how those communities might unravel when certain members are cut out. So in this particular case, yeah, the absence of vultures is thought to have led to an increase in numbers of stray dogs and possibly rats who are consuming the carcasses, cattle carcasses that that the vultures once would have eaten, which is thought to be leading to increases in things like rabies, possibly plague, other diseases, anthrax, that the vultures once did a much better job of containing. And so all of those diseases have knock-on effects. Obviously, they can be contracted by people. And India is home to two-thirds of the world's rabies deaths, so that is not insignificant. And then, of course, there are impacts for the more than human world in terms of that these extra dogs, for example, may be spreading canine parvovirus and other viruses to endangered species like the Asiatic lion and a range of other animals. So, yeah, I was really thinking about how the absence of vultures ripples out into the world to impact on a whole range of others.
Now, the chapter introduces the idea of the dull edge of extinction as a way to understand what's happening with the vultures. Can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Yeah, that I guess is what I've just been hinting at in a way, but I was trying to give it a name to move away from thinking about extinction as this singular phenomenon of the death of the last individual. And we get these very iconic representations of Martha, the passenger pigeon, dying in the Cincinnati Zoo, and think that this is what extinction is, that we can identify the point at which it happens and narrow it down really to the death of that last individual. But by looking at all of these knock-on effects, if you like, and with the vultures, these kinds of ecological impacts and the cultural and religious impacts that I haven't mentioned yet, that, for example, the breakdown of the Parsi funerary system, where the Parsis have traditionally exposed their dead to vultures, and that system has become virtually impossible in the absence of vultures. So all of those kinds of knock-ons, ecological, cultural, to use these big crude categories, ripple out into the world, and they begin well before the death of the last individual, and they continue long afterwards. So rather than thinking about extinction as a sort of short, sharp phenomenon, I'm encouraging us to think about it as a long, drawn-out unraveling that remakes worlds in ways that we are often not fully mindful of.
Thank you so much. Now, as we move into the next chapter, we move into the next case study. And this is a chapter that explores the story of a little community of little penguins that live just inside the mouth of Sydney Harbour. Now, as you tell us in this chapter, this is one of the last penguin colonies left on the Australian mainland. And 8 months out of the year, they return to this harbour to lay eggs and to fledge their young. In this way, they have a strong sense of what you call here site fidelity or philopatry. So because this is going to become important a little later on in this chapter, can you talk a little bit about this notion of site fidelity as it shapes this particular community of little penguins?
Yeah. So this was as you said, a sort of a Sydney moment. It was an opportunity to do some field work closer to home. I've always been interested in the – well, since I found out about them, which wasn't that long ago, in the fact that there were these little penguins living under a very busy ferry wharf and in other places within Sydney Harbour that most people don't know about. They sort of go about their lives quietly. So I was interested in their relationship to that particular place, and – mostly thinking through this work on storying place and on the way that we might think about work that's been done largely focused on the way that human communities and human individuals make sense of place and develop place attachments through lived histories, through ways of understanding and ascribing value and meaning to particular places. This idea from people like Ed Casey's work that that amorphous, you wouldn't want to think about it in exactly these terms. So let's just say in general terms to avoid a technical conversation, that something like an amorphous space, empty space, let's call it, is rendered meaningful through these lived experiences. So the chapter is an effort to think about how various non-humans might story place. And obviously the penguins are the key example, but we might apply that kind of thinking to a whole range of species that have consequential relationships with their places and so are tied to them in different ways. And in the particular case of the penguins, it's this notion of philopatry, of returning to the place in which a bird was hatched, to itself reproduce when it reaches sexual maturity. And those places are not at all exchangeable for penguins. They are sort of deeply tied to these places. And so as this landscape changes in Sydney, as it becomes more and more developed, I was interested in how we think about that, but also how the penguins are sort of excluded from these places that are so consequential to them.
That's right. And the chapter has, at the same time, very moving and really adorable. I mean, really, it makes these penguins into objects that I want to adore, right? In this chapter, in the descriptions that you give here, as a result of this disappearing of their burrows due to urban development, you describe seawalls that are put up, right, that keep them from reaching their burrows. Now, to reach their sites, to give listeners a sense of the complications here, these little penguins, okay, these really, really small penguins, and they're technically called little penguins, right? That's their name.
That's right, yeah.
They go so far as to waddle across a beach, go up a flight of stairs, along the street, down another flight of stairs, and under houses. And these are penguins doing all of this. And so you can kind of imagine the process there. And you talk about people complaining about their nightly 3 a.m. parties on the beach. And it's just this beautiful moment of at the same time, kind of hilarity and also a deeply moving sense of loss. That I think the stories of these penguins and your description of them really brings us into.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad the description works.
Oh, definitely. Very, very much so. It's very evocative. But also, again, it's not just amusing, but also very, very moving. Now, you talked about the importance of understanding and the opportunities that come from understanding the non-human. And every time I say that word, I get a little bit of a twinge because, you know, the book is not trying to create this dyadic sense of human and non-human. So I want listeners to know when I say non-human, it's not because there's a kind of polarity in the book that encourages that. It's just my clumsy use of terminology here. But this idea of the more than human, I think you put it, or creatures, organisms of all sorts, storying places, this is not just about our opportunities for thinking in that way, but also our obligations. So what kinds of ethical obligations, I think the chapter asks, might accompany this understanding of storytelling and placemaking as capabilities of penguins and other not humans, organisms, non-humans more than humans? Can you talk a little bit about that, the ethical implications and the ethical obligations that might come from understanding placemaking in this more capacious and encompassing way?
Yeah, well, that was really what started me down the track of thinking about this. I heard from several people while I was doing interviews out in this part of Sydney Harbour, talking to locals. There was a lot of resentment, not from all of them. There are a lot of really great people who love penguins in that part of Sydney, but there were others who really resented the noise, who resented the fact that they had to keep their dog on a leash. All these kinds of things that make human penguin, especially interactions, so difficult. But there was a general sense that the birds could just go somewhere else, and that was really what I was responding to. This tendency to think about places largely interchangeable for non-humans. I also am worried about the term non-humans, but we'll continue to use it for convenience sake. And this idea of habitat, I think, is really important here, in that it's the main way that we really think about the relationship between a species and particular kinds of places. We say that they have particular habitat that is basically a general set of conditions that are required, that it be a particular temperature, that there be particular kinds of perhaps foliage or ecosystem diversity present for them to eat and to nest and so on. So we get this kind of checklist of requirements that equal appropriate habitat for a species. We never get anything like a sense of an attachment to a particular place, so that it matters for these penguins that they return to this part of the harbour, not to some other part that would be more convenient for people. And that this notion of philopatry, which is literally the love of place, love of one's home, which is the term that the biologists use for thinking about this return to one's natal place. That is another term in biology, I suppose, that I was trying to think about attachment beyond this sort of simplistic requirements of habit of appropriate habitat. And I sort of failed to answer your question there, but it's, my question for myself is: what kind of different ethical obligations does thinking place differently like this open up? So I think the richer sense of how place matters to penguins, that it can't just be exchanged like that. That what happens when penguins lose places, lose their burrows, is that they keep pushing for them. And often they keep going back to them, even though they're no longer appropriate and they fail to reproduce. And so we end up with a smaller and smaller population until extinction happens. So that the work of something seemingly so simple as putting up a seawall is really extinction work, and that understanding place in this richer way helps us to understand the significance of that kind of act.
Now, talking about population numbers, concern with population numbers, this is very much a concern as well that comes up in Chapter 4. Now, Chapter 4 looks at North American conservation programs that are devoted to whooping cranes. The work of conservationists in the U.S. and also in Canada to protect cranes and to teach them to migrate south is explored here in really wonderful ways. And you talk here specifically about Operation Migration. Now, this is a very intensive captive breeding and release program that in many ways has been very successful. So can you maybe bring us into this chapter by talking about Operation Migration and talking a little bit about your own field work that went into this chapter and that you, I think, describe as well early in this in its pages?
Yeah, so Operation Migration, I guess, are one part of a big program. They handle the ultralight-led migration, so the birds being, once they reach a certain age, and all of that breeding is done by two other organizations, the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center, which is part of the U.S. Geological Survey, and the International Crane Foundation. And so they're also very important partners in all of this captive breeding. But then some of those birds then get sent off to Operation Migration, where they're taught to follow an ultralight aircraft to learn this lost migratory route in the effort to establish a second free-living population of whooping cranes in North America. So this would be a migratory route from Wisconsin to Florida, in addition to the one that already exists from up in the north of Canada down to the Gulf Coast of Texas. So, I was really interested in that whole program, the whole effort to create this new eastern migratory population, to breed cranes in captivity, to get them to follow a plane, and in particular, I guess, and I'm probably preempting your next question here. I was
it's okay.
Interested in the violence that goes into the care, the intimate care of these birds.
Mm-hmm. So what was, you describe, so we'll get to violent care in a moment, absolutely, but you described at some point in this chapter dressing up in a costume and, sitting with someone who had a puppet that was a crane's head. What was your ethnographic research in Wisconsin like when you were researching this chapter?
Well, this oddly was sort of one of the chapters I did the least. I spent the least time doing ethnographic research. I spent about a week traveling around Wisconsin and, my U.S. Geography is terrible.
So is mine.
Just outside D.C., Maryland, and talking to people there about cranes, interviewing people at each of those different organizations. So the ethnographic work that is much less visible, I guess, in a lot of the other chapters was more substantial. But I really, the experience of dressing up all in white and walking amongst these cranes was really so surreal that I really wanted to write about it. And it's in large part, as I describe in the chapter, it's because these captive birds that are going to be released, they don't want them habituated to people. They certainly don't want just them to associate people with food and safety. So everybody who is seen by them has to be dressed fully in white and ideally carrying one of these crane puppets that they interact with the birds with as an alternative head. And then often often people will carry these small recorders that that play comforting parental vocalization sounds for the chicks. But in my experience, I dressed up a couple of times in different places, but the one I describe in the chapter was with the Operation Migration folks, and we were in an outdoor pen with birds who were well into their training for following the plane, and it was just really surreal. It was incredibly hot, and the costumes were so stifling that we had to be completely silent. We had to move slowly and carefully, and so it became almost meditative, sort of. And the birds who came up and exploring and pecking at us with their beaks a little bit and following us around as they would follow their parents. And it was a very odd experience. So I felt like it framed the oddness of this whole conservation program really well.
And the oddness is expressed here, at least in part, in terms of something that's now going to super surprise you that I'm asking you about. Get ready. Violent care. I know this is a surprise. You talk about the cranes in terms of this regimes of violent care. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I always want to preface this by saying that I have the utmost respect for all of the people involved in this program. And I think by the end of the chapter, I think it is clear to any reader that I'm largely supportive of what they're doing. I think I think things could be done slightly differently, but I'm largely supportive of the project. But I always ask the people who I interview to read chapters, and this was the one chapter where some, not all of the people I interviewed, had real problems with the way they were being presented, and a big part of the problem, I think, was just this word violence. They really didn't want to think about their practices as violent at all, and for me that was really inescapable. So they are definitely intimate and caring practices where people invest their whole lives and often a lot of their own money in trying to keep the species in the world, a real commitment to the species, but also to the individual birds. And those things are not always the same thing, and that's another one of the tensions I'm exploring in that chapter. So there's an awful lot of care there, but the care is often required, or just it's much easier or only possible with the current funding to do things in particular ways that are also violent, and that are also impact on the individual birds, whether it's holding them down for artificial insemination, or just keeping birds captive for their whole lives, whooping cranes, but also a range of other birds like sandhill cranes that are also kept captive so that they can be incubators for whooping crane eggs for a period of the year. So there's all of this captive life that goes into the maintenance of the species, that goes into what is in many ways a caring conservation program. And I wanted to draw that out.
I mean, the chapter does, I think, a really excellent job in showing these ethical implications, right, and exploring these problems, and then not necessarily saying, here's the right answer, here's the wrong answer, but I mean, really explicitly exploring Haraway's notion of staying with the trouble, right? Staying in the problem, staying with the trouble, staying with the problem, to really explore and think about and try to understand these ethical implications without necessarily claiming that there is a clear way to solve the problems, and that even thinking of it in terms of solving problems makes any sense, right? So I think the chapter is really, really clear about that, that sort of problems are part of the point, right? And thinking through and dwelling in the problems is part of what it seems like you're asking us to do here.
Yeah, I think that was my hope behind looking at the violence that goes on in caring practices, is to think about how we might do things better. If we recognize this as violence, what does it prompt us to do to rethink the way that we're doing these things, to maybe make them less violent in certain ways, or just to own up to that violence? And I think that for me, and the really celebratory images of whooping cranes flying behind ultralight aircrafts, and I couldn't help but put one of those images on the cover of the book.
That's great.
I think they're beautiful images, but they are so often couched in this kind of certainly celebratory but also salvational kind of language where humans and their technology are setting the world to rights, making up for, you know, all of these impacts, helping this to keep this species in the world. But that the behind the scenes work that produces that possibility of cranes following an ultralight is incredibly violent also. And once we allow that violence to slip out of frame, I think it becomes a lot easier to support these kinds of captive breeding programs of various sorts, because we're not really clear on what the stakes are.
I mean, sometimes it's not about thinking that we are necessarily empowered enough to solve a problem or find the answer, but it's about understanding the stakes and understanding the consequences and understanding the problems and finding a way to move forward in an informed and caring way while being in the process of negotiating that. You know?
Yeah.
So in the final chapter, before the epilogue, we move from this context in which we're exploring ideas of violent care and exploring the whooping cranes to exploring a different group of beings, of animals, of birds, and this is a group of Hawaiian crows. Now, Hawaiian crows only survive in captivity. The last free-living crow died in 2002. The crows now only survive in captivity in part due to a lot of factors that you describe here in the chapter, and those factors include forest degradation, increased predation, diseases that are relatively new for that group. And the chapter opens with an account of one of these Hawaiian crows crying out at the death of its partner. So this becomes a chapter that from the very beginning, from the very epigraph of the text, is all about crying and mourning and grieving. Now the chapter considers how crows mourn, how they respond to the death of others of their kind. Can you talk about this a little bit? What does it mean, and what are the consequences for us when we take crows mourning seriously as part of the overall general category of mourning behavior? So more simply put, what does it mean for us, and what can it mean for us to ask if crows mourn?
Yeah, well, this chapter, I guess, philosophically is trying to think about death differently, to move away from a lot of the emphasis in death on this, what François Dastur has called the phenomenology of mortality, to think about, I mean, I guess Heidegger is the most famous example, to think about being towards death, and to think about what is exceptional and unique about the human in terms of its own orientation towards or understanding of its own death. And so I think that this has been, so death has played this role in Western philosophy often of setting up a divide between the human and the animal. So by going to mourning instead of death, in this more phenomenological sense, by looking at mourning, I was trying to think otherwise about death, and to think about a kind of continuity between humans and a whole range of other social mammals and birds, and maybe others, who also mourn. And there's a lot of resistance to thinking, to calling that mourning. Amongst many biologists, they're happy sometimes to call it grief, mourning. A lot of them want to keep just for humans. So there are a lot of questions there about whether and to what extent other animals understand death and so mourn properly or fully. But it's clear that there is grieving going on for a lot of these species when they lose certain others. And so the effort is to think about a kind of evolutionary continuity, how we share to some extent our capacity to mourn with others as a result of our evolutionary relatedness, but then also how there's an ecological, how mourning draws us into ecological relationships with others, how mourning exposes the way in which we are at stake in others. And so to mourn is to acknowledge in some sense, more or less consciously, that we have been remade by the loss of another. And so to mourn for other than humans, to acknowledge how other than humans themselves mourn, is to be implicated in a world of ecological relationships as well, or at least it could be. And that's what the chapter is trying to work through. I should say, just very briefly, because I jumped in with Heidegger instead of saying anything about the Hawaiian crows themselves, that the Hawaiian crows are incredibly beautiful birds, and so the chapter was also motivated by a desire to spend time with them and to think seriously about their plight.
And the chapter actually makes the point quite explicitly that taking the mourning and the grief of non-humans seriously may actually help undo our tendency toward human exceptionalism. And this is a phrase, human exceptionalism, that recurs at several points throughout the book, and it really seems to be at least one important concern of the book as a whole.
Yeah, yeah. I borrow that phrase from Val Plumwood. And yeah, this is really what a lot of the entanglements, the effort to think about mourning, to think about evolutionary relatedness, is all about: resituating the human in ecological, in evolutionary terms, thinking about how, I think Anna Singh has put it most beautifully recently, to think about how human nature is an interspecies relation, I think she says, or an interspecies project. And so the effort to de-center the specialness, to de-center the human, and to rethink the notion that humanity is somehow special and set aside.
Now, you call the chapter itself an act of mourning. What do you mean by that?
I guess it's, as with all of the stories in the book, I'm thinking about them as a kind of performative ethics. I didn't want to just write a chapter about mourning. I wanted the chapter to itself be an act of mourning. A part of what mourning is, of course, storytelling, is the way that we re-situate ourselves in the world, or relearn the world in Thomas Adick's terms, after the event of a loss. And so storytelling has always been, will always be, I imagine, intimately bound up with mourning. So this is an effort to tell a story about mourning itself as an act of mourning, partly to work out some of my own issues, but partly also because I think that witnessing is such a powerful concept here, and there's a little bit of hopelessness in it for me, but there's I feel that there's an important ethical work that is done in the act of bearing witness to extinction. So even if my book has no impact on the world, even if all of the other work that we do on extinction doesn't turn the tide and we continue to lose all of these species, I think there's something important that's done in the work of telling their stories, in the work of giving them some sort of presence in the world, and in the work of trying to articulate what is wrong with what's going on here, as an act of witness that may have no world-changing consequences, but is itself an ethical obligation.
Beautiful. Well, Tom, I think that's a really nice place for us to come to a conclusion here. Now, there's a lot about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. There's a lot of stories, a lot of ways that the chapters are really performing the importance of sort of situating any individual within a network of relationships and communities by being extraordinarily generous about the work of other colleagues and other scholars who you're weaving in, drawing from, and expanding from in all of the chapters. And so it's one of the things, that kind of performance of generosity that I really appreciated, among other things. But of course, there's a lot we didn't get to in all of these pages. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I guess one thing that may be of interest to listeners who are interested in this book is the Extinction Studies Working Group. And we have a website at extinctionstudies.org. And a lot of the people you just mentioned, whose ideas I'm working with, have been in conversation with for years on these things, are also members of that group. People like Debbie Rose, who's beautiful recent book Wild Dog Dreaming, Love and Extinction, I think is another great book in this area, and Evan Kirksey's recent book The Multi-Species Salon, but there's a whole range of other great projects, and it's really a group of people trying to think about what the humanities and to some extent the social sciences have to offer in thinking through extinction. So I would direct people there, I guess.
Great, thank you. So now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm already two chapters into the next book, which wow. is something that I'm really enjoying, and I've just managed to get some funding to allow me to do field work around the world in six different sites looking at human-crow relationships. So in a way, my current book picks up directly from the last chapter of Flightways with the Hawaiian crows, and the Hawaiian crow is one of these six crows, and there are five others. And I'm really just thinking about they're not all endangered. Some of them are crows that are thought to be overabundant and that are being culled. So the extinction is still really a central theme, but I'm also thinking more broadly about what wildlife management is or might be, and our relationships with a whole range of different corvids as a way of thinking about broader issues of multi-species community in the Anthropocene, whether you love or hate that term. So that's the current project, and I've been working on the Hawaiian crow again and some beautiful Indian house crows living in the Netherlands who are, I think, if they're not all dead now, they will be very soon. The Dutch government have given the order to have them all killed. So that has been my latest project, and I'm really looking forward to taking up crow stories in other places.
Well, best of luck with that research, and I hope you have wonderful travels and wonderful trips in the course of doing that work as well. And thank you so much for making time to talk with me about this book. I really enjoyed it, and it's an amazing book, so thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Carla, for taking the time to read it and talk about it and share it with others. It's great to talk to you.
You've been listening to the New Books Network Seminar. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.